I'm Ricky Ellison. I'm the chairman and founder of the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance. Been around missile defense since 1980 with Governor Ronald Reagan. The organization was built right after 9/11 and our move to withdraw from the ABM Treaty in 2003. Our purpose is to educate and advocate for missile defense, for the deployment of missile defense, for the evolution of missile defense, because we believe that it makes not only our nation but the world safer to have these systems in and about the world. Our organization has visited 375 U.S. military bases, but been to all the missile defense sites, most of them in the world. We have particular have just been in all our sites in the Persian Gulf, in the four countries that have U.S. missile defense sites there. Last October, we held the first ever UAE recognition event in Abu Dhabi, and we brought our U.S. Aegis ship, the Mahan, in there with us, along with our troops that remain the missile defenses of that country with us in it. In November of this year, we are looking to host the first ever GCC recognition event in Abu Dhabi with CENTCOM. Today, this discussion is not about the deal. It's not about for or against it. We're not talking about the deal today. This is a discussion and education about the ramifications of a deal going forward in Iran to the specific region of the Gulf and the Gulf countries. And I think we've assembled a great team here, a team that's going to be able to have a relaxed discussion with you. Each of them will be able to present about 10 minutes, and then we're going to open the floor up for questions. As you know, we're in a prelude here to the pass. Has a hearing at 2 o'clock on the same subject. They'd probably be much more circumspect than we are today in discussing the issue. On our team, we've got, I think, one of our best guys in the think tank arena in Washington, D.C. on Iran with Michael Eisenstadt. I think we also have one of the very best air defense soldiers and officers in the Middle East. He was there in creating the Integrated Air Missile Defense Center at UAE. Mike Trolone. We have, I think, one of the best threat analysis guys in the world, UNCLASS, Uzi Rubin. And we have our Brigadier General, former Deputy Director of the Missile Defense Agency, Ken Todorov. So I'd like to start the discussion off with going on our strategic overview with Michael. If you could start off, Michael Eisenstadt.
Thank you, Ricky. And I just want to thank the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance for inviting me here to appear on this distinguished panel and to discuss, for my presentation, the threat, Iran's missile program. And I should actually mention Iran's missile and rocket program, because it's important to actually look at both when considering the threat, because the second part is just as important in many ways for Iran as the first part, the rockets and missiles. Now, if you were to ask me, what are the kind of the iconic symbols of Iran's way of war? I would say three things. First, their reliance on proxies, groups like Hezbollah and the like. Secondly, missiles and rockets. And third, propaganda. Propaganda spin in order to magnify its activities with, in the proxy and rocket and missile arena. And their rocket and missile force play a particularly important role in Iran's national security doctrine and their way of war. And it goes back to the Iran-Iraq war. If you recall, during the war, Iraq early on launched a series of strategic bombardment campaigns against Iran's industrial and economic infrastructure, as well as civilian population centers. Iran responded in kind. Iraq had limited strategic depth, a lot of major cities close to Iran's border, and Iran built a lot of rockets in order to hit these, and then eventually they were able to get missiles, and they were able to range Baghdad and the like. Fast forward to 1988, where you had the final War of the Cities between February and April, where Iraq finally had extended the range of their Scud variants and were able to range in Tehran and bring substantial pressure to bear on Tehran, to the point that a quarter of Tehran's population fled the city during the final stages of the Wars of the Cities. And this played a major role in Iran's decision to seek a ceasefire. The weight of the bombardment from the missiles, as well as the fears that Iraq intended to marry those missiles with their chemical weapons capability and launch them against cities. That played a decisive role, and that had an indelible imprint on Iran's thinking about the importance of long-range strategic bombardment, rocket and missile systems in warfare, and the impact they could potentially have on enemy morale. Since then, rockets and missiles have been central to Iran's way of war, which emphasizes the need to avoid and deter conventional conflict against adversaries. They are all about unconventional warfare. Conventional warfare, large major conventional warfare, is not their way of war. In fact, they refer to the Iran-Iraq war as the imposed war, mainly because Iraq, of course, attacked, but I think on a certain level because that's not their preferred way of waging war if they have to choose. Again, proxy warfare and issuing of threats and intimidation is their preferred way of warfare. So their way of war involves deterring conventional conflict while advancing their anti-status quo agenda via proxy operations and propaganda activities. Now, their deterrence and warfighting triad consists of three components. First, their ability to threaten navigation through the Strait of Hormuz. Second, their ability to conduct terrorist attacks, potentially worldwide. And third, their ability to conduct long-range strikes primarily by missiles or, in the case of Hezbollah, a very large rocket force. And that's part of their deterrent system. Yet, the first two options carry significant limitations. Closing the Strait of Hormuz would be a last resort for Iran, because nearly all their oil exports go through the strait. And their declaratory policy has always been, if we can't export oil through the strait, nobody can. In other words, as long as they're able to export oil through the strait, they have no interest in closing the strait. So that's really their Samson option, closing the Strait of Hormuz. Terrorism also has limitations. We've seen in recent years that I think as a result of improved cooperation between the United States, Israel, and other countries, as well as perhaps developments in the cyber arena and other areas, as well as I think the atrophying of their capabilities in this area, terrorism is not as reliable a tool as it was. They attempted in February of 2012 a series of operations against Israeli targets, presumably in response to Israeli targeting of Iranian nuclear scientists. And just about all of these were bungled or nipped in the bud. If you remember what happened in India with the wife of the Israeli military attaché was shot, and in Thailand, totally bungled operation. So we've seen their tradecraft has deteriorated. And not only that in a war, after you conduct your first series of terrorist actions, it'll probably take a long time to plan follow-on attacks, and by then the enemy's defenses are already up. So really, in many ways, missiles are the backbone of their strategic deterrent because it gives them, in many cases, or some of their enemies may not have sufficient defenses for the missiles to prevent the missiles from getting through, and you have a lot of flexibility in the way you use missiles. So their concept is, I think, to use missiles to mass fires against civilian population centers in order to undermine enemy morale, which is, again, based on their experience during the Iran-Iraq war. And if they can improve their accuracy in the future, they can further stress enemy defenses. Because if every missile is accurate, then you have to engage every missile potentially. Unlike what we've seen in Israel, where a lot of the rockets Israel faces are so inaccurate, they don't have to engage a lot of them. So as we see them improve their accuracy, this will put greater stresses on allied missile defenses in the region. And they'll be able to also target particular military facilities and critical infrastructure that right now they really can't effectively target. Now, again, looking at missile strikes versus terrorism, terrorism provides a degree of standoff and deniability. That's one advantage. So in some cases, terrorism is their preferred way of action. But like I said, they've had problems implementing terrorist attacks in recent years due to the improvement of defenses in friendly countries, in our allies. And for that reason, missiles might be their preferred course of action. Plus, in a fast-moving crisis, again, missiles enable you to achieve cumulative effects in a much more effective way than terrorism. If you're lucky, you might be able to pull off a handful of terrorist attacks. But with missiles, you can conduct operations 24/7 with great intensity, much greater intensity. So I think, and also in the case, for instance, of Israel or the Gulf states, they will be able to hit the homeland, whereas with terrorist attacks, they may not be able to get through in Israel. In the Gulf, some of the countries might be more vulnerable than others, but in some countries, it might be very hard for them to get through as well. Missiles provide a greater chance of getting through if they could get through the missile defenses. They're also very important in terms of, I told you before about psychological warfare, which is a central part of Iran's way of war. Missiles are a central fixture of just about every regime military parade. They're used as symbols of Iran's growing military power and reach. And they're also a key element of Iran's nascent doctrine of nuclear ambiguity. Because when you have parades with missiles where you have banners, death to America, Israel should be wiped off the map, in many people's minds, there's on a subliminal level, I think, a connection between missiles, obliteration of your enemy, and weapons of mass destruction or nuclear weapons. So I think they like to play on that ambiguity and use missiles as a symbolic kind of surrogate for the nuclear weapons that they don't have now and they may not have for a very long time. In terms of their inventory, I think their emphasis is on mass to saturate enemy defenses. And right now, with the introduction of the Fatah 313, which is they're claiming a range of 500 kilometers for it, you have now also rockets that can range as far as their Shahab family of missiles. And again, that increases mass. And also, again, just even if they are to develop in the future nuclear weapons, I think a lot of their missile force will remain conventionally armed to serve as decoys and penetration aids for the nuclear armed missiles. So they'll send salvos out with maybe one nuclear equipped armed missile with a bunch of conventionally armed missiles in order to play a statistical game with their adversaries. Let me just make a final comment about the link to the nuclear program. The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, published a report in November of 2011 where they talked about possible military dimensions of Iran's nuclear program, and it was focused mainly on weaponization efforts. And there were three particular activities out of the about, I think, a dozen activities that they identified that were specifically related to Iran's missile program. First, they mentioned the fact that Iran, before the end of 2003, had conducted engineering studies on integrating a spherical payload into a Shahab 3 reentry vehicle. And the general assumption is that the spherical payload probably was kind of a model of a kind of a nuclear implosion device or the pit of a nuclear implosion device. Still some uncertainty about that, but that seems to be, I think, the dominant assessment. Second, they tested a multi-point initiation system to set off a hemisphere-shaped high explosive charge whose dimensions were consistent with the Shahab 3's payload chamber. Again, that would probably be, again, the explosive material around the core, presumably, of a nuclear device. And then finally, they worked on a prototype for a firing system that would enable the detonation upon impact or of an airburst 600 meters above the target for a missile warhead. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the way it deals with the possible military dimensions, and I don't want to editorialize, but I'll just say my own opinion is very problematic because if you look at the agreement, agreement between the IAEA and Iran for dealing with possible military dimensions, it's very unclear in terms of what Iran is being asked to provide in terms of information, and it looks like they're being asked to answer questions, but however, as long as they answer the questions, it's not clear that how they answer it has any connection to whether sanctions are lifted and whether the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action goes forward. So in the end, my concern is, and we've heard a lot of discussion about this, is that we won't get clarity about these issues as we go forward. And the problem is, unless you know who are the people involved in these activities that I mentioned before related to the missile program and what facilities were involved, we're not going to have, you know, it's clear we're not going to be following those in the JCPOA. We're not going to be watching those. So there's nothing to stop Iran from continuing these activities under the JCPOA as they go forward. And in fact, it's problematic. It's not even clear if it would be a violation of the NPT. I think you could make a good case it would be a violation of the JCPOA, because you're not supposed to engage in any weapons-related activities. But the thing is, these kind of things could happen at low kind of footprint type of facilities, and we wouldn't necessarily even know about it. So I leave you saying that, first of all, I think this will remain an open question as in terms of what they did in the past with regard to their missile program and its tie into the nuclear program. And from a policy point of view, I think it's also problematic not to get clarity on the possible military dimensions, because if Iran believes that they were able to successfully negotiate themselves out of this corner and not deal with the PMD issues in the past, I think that will increase their incentive in the future to do things which are prescribed by the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the NPT, because they believe that, again, they'll be able to negotiate themselves out of it. So that concludes my comments, and I look forward to the other presentations and the discussion afterwards.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Our next guest is the world-known threat analysis. He was a former head of the Israeli Missile Defense Agency, so to speak, the first one. He has spoken around the world. There's nobody better that understands the Iranian missile threat and cruise missile threat than this gentleman here in an unclassified position. This is, obviously, we are not discussing Israel. We are discussing the GCC and the protection of the Gulf here, and it's been a great honor for Uzi to be here with us. Uzi Rubin.
Thank you for inviting me. We are talking about high technology, and we are spying for it. We couldn't make the computer. So what I'm going to do is a comfortable audience. I'm going to run it from the laptop. I think it's close enough for you to see, because my show is very graphic. What I want to show is the technical aspects of the Iranian missile program, which in my opinion shows that the doctrine is a missile force that is replacing an air force. Air force for the public, as they predicted in the past, how to build a strategic force without air force. Although they have some air force, but they're investing in their missiles. This is a picture of a lineup of missiles in the Tehran Military Museum, and you see three families here. On the left side are the space launchers. They have a lot of significance for future ICBMs, we won't talk about it. The second family has a range from between 1,300 kilometers and 2,200 kilometers. The third one, the smallest one, has the range between 600 and 700 kilometers. You see the gap between 700 kilometers and the next range is 1,300 kilometers. This 700 kilometers gap means, in my opinion, that they have actually two theaters of operation. They are designed at Taylor in the force against two distinct theaters of operation. The nearby theater of operation, which is the Gulf States plus North Israel and Saudi Arabia, and everything else beside it in the Middle East, which is the rest of Saudi Arabia, maybe Yemen, and of course Israel. So with this view, let's see what they have. The basic rocket was an unguided rocket called the Zhang 2, some old Chinese design, unguided, range quite impressive of 250 kilometers and more than half a ton of warhead, which is devastating. See some pictures from Syria of the scud warhead does to a city. Two problems with this, they could manufacture cheap and quickly. Two problems with this, the range is too short. If you're talking about war in the Gulf, it's covering some major cities, but it's not covering many of them. The other thing is accuracy, it's very bad. So they did a very formidable job and turned this unguided rocket, in the top, into a guided rocket. Actually, a small ballistic missile. You have the same thing, Lockheed Martin makes a GMLRS, used to be an unguided system that we used in the Dutch War in 1931. Weapon fires from a multiple launcher into a guided rocket. Now it has a precision of about 5 meters. Very impressive. So they did the same thing. They took the unguided rocket, which has a small section in the rocket motor that turns it around for accuracy, and instead of that, they put a guidance section with winglets, with inertia system, and now with the GPS, that can now it's a precision weapon. From with distance of 700 meters, it's now a few meters. So it's very important. Another thing is they can actually renovate all the old rockets into precision rockets, because the new section replaces the old section. It's just bolt it out and bolt it in. So with this new range, it's 50 kilometers more. Another thing is they lighten the motor a little, so it's now they have 50 kilometers extra, and with this they cover much more of that area. And with their new precision capability, that this time we have 6, 7, or 8 sub-variants. I cannot count all of them, but the main ones are ground-to-ground, very accurate, anti-ship missiles with the seekers, both electromagnetic and optical seekers. They have now a bomber section, which disperses bomber seekers. You can see the movie here. With the show. Never mind. And this is an illustration from the Iranian publication of the anti-ship missile Spur. It's diving on the target in the Persian Gulf, and that target is an American aircraft carrier. Actually, whether they gave the Chinese, the Chinese gave them the anti-ship ballistic missile, but don't laugh it off. It's a serious threat. Now, as it was mentioned before, might you mention, they did another jump and increased the range of that to about 500 kilometers. I did some back of the envelope calculation, and sorry to say, this is good engineering. Probably went from metal to composite material in the rocket motors. And with 500 kilometers, accurate missiles, they can go all the way, almost all the way to Yemen. Now, the beauty here for them is it's a cheap missile, the manufactured quantities, and the arsenal is quite high. Another, this is the production line, we're showing the production line. Look at those sections here. The top here, those are the guidance sections. They are modular. They can get the old rockets and turn them into accurate rockets. Another line is the ballistic missile line. They took the Scud C, which they call Shahab 2, and completely renovated it into a modern missile without wings, without winglets. It's much more accurate, about 100 kilometers more range. The range and the warhead, the range now is about 700 kilometers. Warhead again, more than half a ton. And the manufacturer that they are showing the storage, and twice they showed last year and this year too. In the storage that they show, mostly down the Kayans. Now the Kayan 700 kilometers is not against us. With that range, it's against the GGC and Saudi Arabia. As I say, the different, the nearby theater. So this is the mainstay for this theater, and they're manufacturing them like sausage. Scud missile, they took a drone, which is used for targets, and turned it into some kind of unmanned bomber. They call it a Kara, with a range of, they say, 1,000 kilometers, it's not important. What's more important is to air launch Scud missile, which is just uncovered. They call it Ya'ali. This is a prototype we showed last year, and it has, again, this range of 700 kilometers. You can see this 700 kilometers. That's a range of interest in the GCC. Quantities, I assume that the guided rockets, the Fatah 110, without the guided section, you have to take it to more than 1,000. They have manufactured them since the early 2000s, 2003. So they can convert all of them. So they have to account, take it to account about 1,000 warheads, both anti-ship and ground to ground. The Kayam, I assume a production rate of about 53 a year, like the Shahabs. So by now, since the first test of 2010, should they have about 200. The Karar is 50 and the Yaar is pretty. Basing mode, everything is based in underground tunnels. We have dozens of pictures of tunnels from above and one picture of the tunnel from the inside. They released picture of what the missile they showed are actually rocket. But anyway, you can assume that the same thing is used for the ballistic and guided rocket missiles. Another feature, everything that moves above ground on the launcher is camouflaged to look like a civilian craft. So when you enter there, you can distinguish it as a civilian craft. That means counting leveraging on a Western standard of approaching view. And getting immunity from that, actually shielding from civilian traffic. And their mindset in wartime, and you can see from this picture here, is an outline in the desert, but there is some. Full size of American airplanes in the dark. You can see the runways here and the buildings, and you can see the holes of the rockets that they use under the fire here. And here is the concentration. The whole thing is about 2 kilometers, 3 kilometers long, and about 150 kilometers long. In other words, they are trained to attack the U.S. air bases. And they say it's a U.S. air base. In the naval area, you can see a mock-up of aircraft carrier Nimitz that they built, floating mock-up. Maybe it had to do with the movie that some joint venture with someone. Anyway, they took this mock-up and put it in the Gulf and bombarded it with the guided missile. You can see here the explosion of one of the Fatah 110, whatever they call it. They didn't sink the thing. Instead, they stormed it and occupied it with civilian guard, whatever. I don't know exactly the exercise, but it was a real exercise. And that shows the mind's negation. And here is, if you don't believe the picture, you can listen to what they say. Here is Ali Shamkhani. Today is the secretary of the Iranian Supreme Council. The Supreme Council is headed by the Supreme Leader, which make all the key decisions. He was formerly Minister of Defense. And in his words, Iran will launch a blitz of missiles on the Gulf states. He's talking about the Gulf states, targeted not only against U.S. bases, but we are going to target the Gulf states themselves, in the region, strategic targets such as refineries, power stations, so on. They believe they can win the war with those missiles, even without nuclear. So here is the Iranian speaking very directly. They don't make any bones about it. But that was the nearby arena. Let's look at the further arena. The mainstay is Shahab 3 Alpha. Now it's called Kader F. They made it, lightened the structure, so it's a lighter structure. Range came out to 1,300 kilometers from about 2,000 kilometers. And now they're making them accurate. They're adding the QC, like they did with the rocket. They're putting the QC to the ballistic missile, so from the distance of 2,000 kilometers, they hit targets from within 100 to 200 meters. No, the United States doesn't have the capability. The only guys that have some capability now are the Chinese. So this is kind of a Chinese-style capability, and it's going to be operational perhaps next year. And now they revealed a few months ago a cruise missile, more than 2,000 kilometers, but this is the real kind because it flies not with the earth inside the weapons, treetop level, and can weave for 2,000 kilometers. Now, why I'm showing this is that everything that I showed you that goes to the far theater, they have a 2,000 kilometer missile, you don't have to fire it to 2,000 kilometers, you can fire it to 300. Everything I showed you from the far theater is good for the nearby theater. So when you are talking the quantities, you have to add the quantities. And from the point of view of the defender, all together, the guided rockets plus the Kalam, plus the Kaderev, plus the Karab, plus the Sumar, which is start manufacturing, we are talking about more than 1,600 warheads about now. We are starting it for a year, probably come out in a few years to about 2,000 warheads. Each one of them, as I said, at least half a ton. So I'm not talking about unguided rockets with few kilograms like that, but something which can really cause real damage. And to conclude, the Iranian arsenal shows a very clear distinction between the nearby target and the far target, while everything for the far target will go to the near target, there is an overlap. More than, as I said, 1,600 warheads. Growing proportion of that arsenal is becoming accurate. We are adding the accuracy, renovating or rebuilding the missile for accuracy in the future. Everything will be pinpoint precision with GPS. That's not that terrible. A weapon like that with the GPS can hit an airport, an airplane can hit a runway, it can hit actually, close enough, fortified shelter in an airbase. The doctoring apparently assumes air inferiority. And it's built, remember that they have a US educated military people. So they understand the Western way of making war, and they're saying we understand how the West makes war, and we are building our capability against each component of Western superiority. That means they are not building to get air superiority. They are assuming air superiority will lead to the Western side. And for that, they build up sheltering against air power, camouflage on the road against being attacked on the way to the launch point, accurate missiles that can hit at the road, Western capability to hit. That means that there is a war that tried to reduce the capability of the other side to conduct their operation, both by hitting his bases and the military infrastructure. Try to find a war without power stations. This is as necessary as and with these unhappy remarks, let me conclude.
Thank you, Uzi. Appreciate the insight. Our next guest is Mike Trolone, former colonel. He oversaw commanded Patriot units in UAE and in Bahrain. I got a chance to visit him in Bahrain when he had that. But what I think he's most known for is standing up the first ever integrated air missile defense center that's in Abu Dhabi. And this is a center, I think, mostly funded by the State Department to bring in other, the GCC countries, to be able to educate and be able to transfer information so the whole team can fight instead of just one country at a time can fight in this battle. Mike is from Abu Dhabi, so he came all the way out here from Abu Dhabi. So let me introduce Colonel Mike.
Thank you, Ricky. Thank you all. So my point in this today is my previous two speakers talked about the why of we need a Gulf Shield. What I'll talk about today over the next 10 to 15 minutes, and then Ken will take it further to the strategic level, I'll focus on the tactical level of how do we create this Gulf Shield and the need for it after we've seen this. So why am I here today? I'm here today because of the genesis of the Gulf Shield in 2003. On the first day of the Operation Iraqi Freedom, my Patriot unit was packed up and getting ready to move into Iraq to defend the Marine Expeditionary Forces. On my early warning screen, a missile indicator light came up, and the crosshairs literally were placed on top of my unit. Fortunately, because of the coalition architecture that was in place with the Kuwaitis, the U.S. assets throughout that, a Patriot unit was able to detect, engage, and destroy that. And I'm literally here today because of the genesis of the Gulf Missile Shield. What I'm sad to say, though, is that after 13 years later, we are less prepared today to fight that same war than we were back in 2003. Despite the enormous amount of money and assets placed into the region, our ability to fight as a coalition is less now than it was a decade ago. So today I'd like to talk about how do we fix that. What are the three particular areas to focus on to make this Gulf Shield a reality? One is the need for greater sensor and command and control integration. The second thing I'd like to talk about is the need for regional maintenance and logistics support to keep those systems operational. And then lastly, the need for multilateral training so that we learn how to work together and defend tonight, as our colleagues said. So the first thing I'd like to talk about is the need for sensor integration. Ricky and his team have a great pamphlet outside that lays down the GCC assets and what we have. The array of missile defense we have now in the Middle East rivals nothing that we had during the Cold War. It is phenomenal. The U.S. assets alone, from Patriot systems to Aegis BMD ships to forward-based Tippy 2 radars and other space-based and airborne systems is phenomenal, all tied together on a secret network that's able to provide a common operational picture. The GCC has a similar array of assets, from the first international THAAD battery to the most advanced Patriot Config 3 systems in the world, better than our U.S. assets have currently in theater, to other long-range early warning systems. But the problem is they're all stovepiped. Whereas in 2003, we were able to tie in the Kuwaiti Patriots with our Patriots, now we're not due to policy limitations. The GCC does have a rudimentary system. It's called the Hazam al-Tawami, or HAT system. It ties together their air operations centers, but it was neither designed nor capable of tying together the ballistic missile early warning systems. It just doesn't have the bandwidth. The GCC over the last 4 years has been trying to integrate their early warning systems, the ballistic early warning. There was just a recent article in the Dubai paper several days ago talking about that. But because of internal dissension and because of U.S. policy restrictions, they've been unable to pull that together. And then lastly, it was only 1 year ago that we recognized the GCC as an entity, allowing them to actually purchase systems as a coalition, something we've done with NATO for decades. We've only just allowed this in the GCC last year. So the first crucial step is to integrate these sensors so that we can get past the politics and the policy challenges to take the assets that are already there and put them onto one network in order to give a true, what I call, mud-to-space sensor integration. First topic. Second topic is, once we have the sensors integrated, we got to talk about command and control. Over the last 12 to 24 months, the GCC has shown an unparalleled level of cooperation as they partner against, in Yemen, Iraq, and Syria, against the Houthis and the ISIS. The cooperation that we've seen in the Gulf is amazing. However, we continue to work with them bilaterally, U.S. to Bahrain, U.S. to UAE, U.S. to whatever country, instead of looking at them multilaterally and cooperatively. We need to break through this stovepipe and start interacting with them as a cooperative entity to increase our interoperability and our integration. The number one challenge we face is not technology, it's not cost, but it's policy. We have to break down the policy barriers in order to get through and integrate the things we already have. This is not without challenge. The cyber threat is real. You know, the ability to integrate this system is challenge and is put at risk. But we have the technology in place to get around this. Our enemy will attack us at our weak points, but we must leverage the technology and get around the policy to integrate these systems. Because the failure to do this is the loss of treasure and lives. Just last week, a week ago today, a Yemeni Houthi missile struck a depot, coalition depot in Yemen, killing over 60 coalition forces. We need a GCC Gulf Shield now, and we need to work through that as we go through. The second point I'd like to talk about is the need for greater maintenance and logistics. The threat continues to evolve. As my two colleagues talked about, it only gets better and more accurate. The time of flight in the Gulf region is measured in minutes and seconds. We don't have the luxury of being semi-ready or on standby. We have to be ready 24/7, 365. As Saudi Arabia demonstrated just 2 weeks ago, you never know when the next missile is going to fly, and they successfully engaged a missile coming in down in the southern region of Saudi Arabia on the border of Yemen. But despite the enormous growth in missile defense assets in region, we have seen zero capability growth in our logistics and maintenance capability in region. We still have to send all of our missiles, both the Gulf and the U.S., back to the United States to be repaired or recertified at great cost and great time. And as we alluded to on the number of missiles that are poised to attack the Gulf region and our ability, you know, it's a physics number. If we're putting two up for every one of theirs, every missile we have out of theater is one less missile that we have to defend. So it's critical that we do this. This is something we've done already in NATO. Once again, we have depot facilities in NATO to recertify missiles. So we must establish a missile facility now and keep our missiles in country so that we can increase our ability to defend tonight. Nothing's more frustrating than having a system down. Having, again, fought in OIF and several other contingencies, you know, when your system goes down, you don't have a spare part, it's disheartening. How many of you have been stuck on the side of the road with a flat tire and didn't have a spare? Fortunately, you could pick up a phone and within minutes or maybe an hour, you can have a spare there and you're on your way. But what if you're a missile defense system? What if you're down and you're protecting a hospital or a city or a forward operating base? And that part's not weeks away, it's months and in sometimes years to get that part back into region. This is the current state in the Gulf region when it comes to depot and warehouse supply. Each country has its own stockage of parts, but it's very limited. When those parts are exhausted, they have to reach back to the states or they have to send a part back, taking 12 to 24 months to return. We have a need for a warehouse in the region right now. Once again, we've done this in NATO during the Cold War, having that facility there. It's time for us now to have that in region. That'll increase our operational readiness during peacetime to enhance our deterrent capability, and during wartime or contingency operations, when the civilian air flights shut down and we can't bring in spare parts, it'll give us a ready reserve both for our U.S. units and for our Gulf partners in order to keep their systems ready. As the adage goes, tactics wins battles, but logistics wins war. And we are unprepared to win this logistics war currently in the Gulf. So now that I've talked about sensor and command and control integration and the need for greater logistics, I'd like to end by talking about something I'm very passionate about, and it's about training and multilateral training at that. During the 1990s and early 2000s, we had several U.S. units deployed overseas in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. We trained day in and day out with our counterparts, greatly increasing our readiness. The success we had on day one of Operation Iraqi Freedom was because of that partnership and that training. But despite the unprecedented numbers of U.S. units that we have in region right now, we do not have that same level of integration and same level of training that we did two decades ago. The leaders are confused by the policy, Title 10 versus Title 22. Can I do exercises or I can do training? As Ricky alluded to, I was chartered to stand up the SunCon Integrated Air and Missile Defense Center 5 years ago. Only the charter of that center was to do multilateral training with our Gulf partners. Only last year, 4 years after the inauguration, was it given the authorities in order to conduct training. We need to expand this training and partnership now between the units, and we need to be able to defend tonight. So the last thing I'll leave you with is that once we have our bilateral training done, we need to do this multilateral training, because missile defense is a team sport. As you hear Ricky say in most every speech he gives, you know, it takes Air Force sensors, Navy ships, Army ground components, and when you add in the complexity of adding in our coalition partners, it really is difficult and complex. After Desert Storm, we began an exercise in West Texas and southern New Mexico that brought together joint and coalition teams in order to practice this. Exercise Roving Sand was the key success to our ability to go 9-for-9 engagements in Operation Iraqi Freedom. But since 2003, we've stopped that exercise because of the high op tempo that we've had with our deployed U.S. forces. It's time to reinvent Exercise Roving Sands into a regional air missile defense exercise so that we can train and practice with our Gulf partners how we will fight. This will enable us again to defend tonight. So in closing, the time is right for a Gulf Shield. What I've talked about today, the need for greater sensor and command and control integration, the need for increased maintenance depot facilities and warehousing, and finally the need for multilateral training, all that's simple. But what it requires is approval and advocacy from the highest levels of Congress and policymaking staffs. This is not a need for new more money. This is not a request for more people. This is simply a request to allow our GCC partners who have already purchased our systems to train and integrate them with us as partners. We need to authorize it, we need to encourage it, and we need to hold people accountable. So I challenge you today in this room, who will be that advocate? Who will prevent the needless loss of life that we saw a week ago with that missile attack in Yemen? And who will be the leader to take us and implement this Gulf Shield? Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Our next guest, he's a pretty special guy. I don't know if any of you guys have been around, but you know that Russian helicopter Rambo. He was one of the few men in our armed forces that could fly that Russian helicopter, and he did that. But Ken Todorov is also in charge of the Integrated Air Missile Defense for the Joint Chiefs, and was promoted up to become a Brigadier General to do the Deputy Director of MDA, which he still is employed, but he's set to retire next month. So without further ado,
well, thanks, Ricky. You sort of blew my cover, because now they know I'm a helicopter pilot. They know I absolutely know nothing about missile defense. So you kind of, those of you who know me already know that. But it's good to see a lot of our very familiar faces here and some that are new to me. It's great to be back. It's been about 6 weeks since I left the Missile Defense Agency. And it's been a strenuous 6 weeks trying to figure out when to water the tomato plants and when to get my daily run in and when to get to the Starbucks every day. So this is kind of my first sort of toe in the water back into the public eye here, but an honor to be here, Ricky, and to my colleagues. Thanks for your excellent remarks. What I hope to do today is try to tie everything you've heard together a little bit at the operational and even the strategic level. I come at it from the hats that I'm familiar with, which is the warfighter hat, having been flown helicopters for a lot of my career, but in the last 6 years of my professional life, I've been working in and around the missile defense community. And I know that you said that this is not about the deal today, and so we're not going to talk about the deal, but I do want to make just a comment at the outset, in that, in my opinion, the deal does not matter. So it's okay that we're not talking about the deal, because regardless of whether or not it goes through or not, this mission set, the work that collectively that these gentlemen have talked about, is going to be vitally important. As Uzi mentioned, the threat is not going away. And he very nicely laid it out in a lot of different aspects. Let me just succinctly say, Iran has the largest short and medium range ballistic missile inventory in the region. And that is only going to increase. Those numbers are going to increase, and I'll talk about how that really drives us to change our strategic thinking toward defeating, or at least defending against that large inventory here as I get through my comments. So the threat will continue to increase. It'll continue to grow in quantities and sophistication. It's got to be something that strategically we think about it. There's been a lot of talk, going back again to the deal. I'm not questioning or debating the merits of the deal itself, but I've heard a lot of people say, well, if the deal happens, then maybe we don't need as much of this missile defense stuff anymore. Absolutely irrelevant to me. Happens or not the deal, we absolutely need to maintain our commitments to the region, to the GCC, and to our partners, and for our own, the protection of our own interests and assets in the region. I think we have done that. I know within the Department of Defense we have done that, but you can look to the broader United States government. Clearly, the work that went on earlier this year at Camp David with our GCC partners, the statements that were put out amongst the partner nations and the administration here clearly say that we are committed to this. They listed five categories of commitments, things like fast-tracking the arms transfers to our partners, counterterrorism, maritime security, cybersecurity, and ballistic missile defense. So any sort of notion that our commitment is lessening or will lessen because of the deal, I think, is ill-advised. And I really don't think that'll happen. I think everyone recognizes that the commitment must be maintained. We've seen a large, again, my MDA hat, I can just tell you that during my time there, we did extensive work with our GCC partners in this arena. We had ongoing negotiations bilaterally, and it was a great point that Mike made. We got to get out of the bilateral business and into the multilateral, but with three GCC nations currently ongoing, and with the GCC now as an entity, which is a great step forward. These countries, to their credit, recognize that what Uzi talked about, what Mike talked about, the threat is not going away, and so they know they need to do something seriously about it, and I think we're on the right track. So let me talk briefly about what I think potentially are three keys to getting us sort of down the road. And again, Mike did a beautiful job, frankly, of talking specifically about sensors, logistics, and training. Those are all very, very important. But more broadly, I will just say my first key is greater cooperation in a number of areas. And I think you hit it nail on the head with regard to policy. A lot of this doesn't center around stuff. We've got a lot of stuff in the region now. A lot of it doesn't center around the technical know-how, the how-to. A lot of this centers around policy, around willingness of governments, not only ours, but our GCC partners, to cooperate with each other. So it can't just be U.S. to nation X cooperation. It's got to be cooperation amongst themselves. And I think a good place to start there, again, Mike alluded to it, is with the shared early warning. Let's not solve world hunger, metaphorically, in the region with everything right off the bat. Let's start with a problem we know how to solve. Let's get nations to the table and collectively work the shared early warning problem. If we start with that, I think that'll be not a quick win, but it's a very doable win, and something that we can accomplish in the shortish term, and then set us off on the right foot to building trust, building those partnerships, trust, and getting us down the road to some of the other problems that Mike succinctly talked about. So collaboration has to be one. My second key to addressing this problem in the region is a broader approach. So Ricky, God bless him and his organization for what they do, Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance, but sometimes we all collectively fail to remember that it's not just missile defense, ballistic missiles, it's about integrated air and missile defense. And I think that we have to take the broader approach. Uzi again mentioned cruise missiles. He mentioned rockets, some of the other the threats that could come the way of those GCC nations, a very important region, obviously, for obvious reasons. But it's not just the ballistic missiles. It's the other things that could reach out and touch us or our partners in the region that we have to be concerned about. So let's not just think about this from a ballistic missile standpoint. Let's think about all the other threats that are in the region and could reach out and bite us. And to our credit of our now General Dempsey, who was the chairman in December of 2013, he signed a six-page vision for our own Department of Defense, the vision for joint integrated air and missile defense, talked about integrating all those things, UAS, cruise missile, low RCS cruise missile, and ballistic missile defense into one sort of operating sort of think space, if you will. We too have to sort of translate that to our partners in the GCC. So again, another key is to think beyond ballistic missiles and think to the larger threats that could, again, could come to bear in a bad day. Because keep in mind, I think Uzi pointed out, it's not going to be just them lobbing salvos of ballistic missiles. There's going to be all matters of threats that could come our way, and you can't deal with them in a vacuum. Another, along the IAMD lines, if you drive up I-95 today and you look to your right, a little bit to the east, just north of Baltimore, you'll see a large airship up there, the J-Lens. And I'm not here to plug the J-Lens. I know I got some J-Lens friends in the audience. It's what I'm here to plug is the capability that it brings to bear. That is a very, very specific system that could come to bear. Again, there are others like it. But a J-Lens-like capability, I think, in regard to IAMD is key. The other plug I want to make here is to our shipmates in the United States Navy. A lot of people think this is, you know, the Patriot Thad, which is all true, very much part of the equation. But our own Navy and partner navies, I think, could join in the fight to a greater extent and work in the IMD arena for sensors particularly. The third key I'll just talk about briefly, and then I'll get off the stage, is something that is the debate is alive and well when we talk about homeland ballistic missile defense. And we hear a lot of people talking about the cost curve and the right and the wrong side of the cost curve and what are we doing left to launch to address the problem. I think that that issue is relevant to this discussion amongst GCC nations as well. You've heard about the threat today. You've heard about the numbers. You've heard about at some point there are going to be way more interceptors than we can, way more ballistic missiles or other kinds of threats than we can have one-for-one interceptors to intercept with. So what are the other things that we're going after intellectually as for our own nation, but also that may translate to our GCC nations as well? Directed energy, cyber, not just defensive cyber, hugely important, but what are offensive cyber are we doing that could come to bear here? Railgun, which is a capability that's being developed, is that a capability that can be shared, again, with our partner nations there? This is down the road, sort of a longer-term ways to address the problem, but I think very relevant. So those sort of dealing with the cost curve and not trying to buy our way out of this problem, an unsustainable strategy, you've heard a lot of people talk about that. I think it's true for this region as well. We have to have an eye on that and an eye on to the future to think about how we deal with the problem longer-term. So if I had to sum up my thoughts on this, I would say that really it's about the sum of the parts. It's about greater cooperation amongst us and our partner allies. It's about cooperation amongst themselves. It's about going beyond the bilateral into the multilateral. It's about thinking about this larger than the BND problem, but rather the IAMD problem, which I think is more realistic. And it's about thinking about the future and think ways to counter this threat that go beyond sort of the traditional hit to kill, which is always going to be part of the equation, but I think will never be a sort of a one-stop shop to dealing with the problem. So again, thanks to all of you for being here, and look forward to some questions. I know that the rest of the panel does as well. Thanks, Ricky.
Thanks, Ken. We're going to open it up, but I'd like to ask the first question. I'm going to ask it to you, Ken. When the deal goes forward, what's the best policy that we should as a country do to ensure or mitigate risk to the GCC countries from an economic, more powerful Iran going forward? But what would be the number one thing we could do on a policy level?
I would just kind of bridge back to where I started in my remarks, which is maintain our commitments. A realization that deal or no deal doesn't change the equation. And that ballistic missile defense, and as I argue, integrated air missile defense, ballistic missile defense being a subset of that, will increasingly become more and more important. So the worst mistake we can make, if the deal happens, is to say, all right, we can take our eye off the prize, we can let our guard down, we can take a pause, we can, you know, focus in a different area. Absolutely not, in my opinion. So to put it in a positive light, if the deal happens, I think that the best thing we can do for an increasingly growing, powerful militarily Iran is to maintain our commitments and do a lot of the things that the other panelists talked about.
And then the next, be more proactive, more aggressive? What would be the next thing after sustaining?
I think to Mike's point about going beyond bilateral and again, increased cooperation amongst the nations, cross-cutting, not just one-on-one sort of in stovepipes, is going to be the key. So yes, more aggressive approach toward that.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, questions?
General Andrea Schmal with Reuters. To your point about increasing cooperation, what is it, you know, what are the impediments to that? Is the, you know, and how, what is the, you know, step-by-step things, what has to happen in sequence? How do you see that? You see some progress since the summit, and what is your best estimate now for when some initial, you know, air defense, integrated air defense capability can exist?
I think I'm going to punt that one to Mike, because I know he's more in tune with the current in that region.
I think what we saw in late July, August with the Camp David summit was critical. We now have presidential policy direction to move forward with a Gulf Shield. We did not have that before. The key thing as we go through this is it's very similar to what we did in Europe in the 50s as we built up NATO and built this deterrent capability against the Soviet threat. In the GCC now, we have to similarly have the breakdown of those impediments where we were bilateral, increase that multilateral cooperation, and quite frankly, the world has changed, and we need to get beyond saying the immediate answer of being no, we don't want to share data, to getting to yes, we need to share data. And particularly in missile defense, as my colleague said, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. To hook those sensors together will increase our capability exponentially just by tying those together. Instead of having a stovepipe in Kuwait and a stovepipe in Saudi and a stovepipe in UAE, to see that tied together will enable us to do that. And it, so it's breaking down, I would say, the mid-level barriers. And as I alluded to in my conclusion, it's finding an advocate at state and DOD to push this through to conclusion. And that's really what we need. We need, I would argue, a target team or a workforce set up to push this through. Otherwise, we're just going to continue to have great words and great, you know, discussions. We're really not going to see the hard implementation occur.
So you don't see that person in place now at state or DOD?
I have not seen the fruition of a Gulf Shield in my 13 years in region, so I have not seen that happen yet.
I'm not going to speak for the department, obviously, but I have seen momentum and realization amongst very senior leaders in the department toward the need for this. So I don't know if there's a person, but I know at a, you know, very high levels within the department, the light bulbs have come on that there has got to be greater cooperation. We've got to get through the policy roadblocks that are impeding some of the progress now, for the reasons that were mentioned, for the reason that the threat increasing is not going to go away, it's going to only increase. We've got to come at it a different way, and the stovepipe approach is not working. So I guess, you know, a good first step, I would argue, that there is a senior leader realization that there's a problem and we've got to break through the barriers. Now, the how to do that is arguably the harder of the steps, but at least there is a realization, which I think is, frankly, 5 years ago, I'm not sure that would have said that that was true.
And what about the timetable question? Have seen something that came in place, the rudimentary, did it together here?
Oh, I would think it's years. You know, the precursors are set, the systems are set. Now it's putting in and expanding that infrastructure, as I alluded to with what's called the HAT system. It's expanding that capability. It's not that there's not a capability. It's allowing those countries to cooperate. So I would think, you know, particularly on the sensor piece that was talked about, it's close.
It's a short term. We know how to do this. It's a matter of getting through. I don't want to give you months, quantify it to that extent. But I'll say it's a short-term issue, and we know how to do it. So let's break through the policy barriers and get at it.
So within a year?
Would a year be 12 months? I mean, I'm kidding. I said I wasn't going to give you months. I say that's maybe slightly optimistic, but not much, much more than that.
Mike, I just want to follow up, but I can't. The mitigation of risks for sharing data and bringing the GCC cooperative in, is it friendly fratricide? Is it shared intelligence that may get out? What's the biggest showstopper for our warfighters in sharing cooperative data on this specific integrated air missile defense capabilities?
No. Excellent question. And I truly think it's the threat of cyber. That threat has evolved so much over the last 5 years. We've seen in the newspapers the various attacks, both on our civilian architecture and then our DoD architecture. That is our greatest concern. And that is a valid concern and something we have to be worried about as we integrate. But I believe there are technological systems in place that provide the right guards and barriers to allow us to share that data, both in peacetime and in contingencies, where we can dial up and dial down what we want to share and who we want to share that with, and that we have the ability to protect that system and architecture to enable those sensors to be tied together. So I think that's our greatest challenge right now. And again, it's something new, and like anything new, it's scary. So our immediate answer is no, we don't want to tie it together because we're worried, but let's work through that and find the right technological systems in place to allow us to do what we need to do.
Tom Trudell from Northrop Grumman. I agree that policy seems to be the major roadblock. So you have policy on one side, then you have the technology on the other. That, you know, you kind of indicate that there are many companies are working on those solutions, but as an industry, what are the concrete things that we can do to help facilitate the kind of moving the policy issue forward? Because we're seeing ourselves being hamstrung with what we can do in the region to help solve these problems simply because we don't even know the pressure point for policy. Who is the pressure point for policy?
I think we often, I say we, the Department of Defense and industry don't do enough together. We often sort of go and you make your pitch and the department makes the pitch. I think there's real strength in to try to, you ask what you could do. I think we could work, not you and me, but industry and the department closer together to, you know, lock arms and go up and make this case would be something that, you know, levels above me certainly, but would be effective. And, you know, the policy roadblocks, frankly, there's some within the Department of Defense, but there are others in other parts of the government, state, and others, the commerce even, that I think we have to address.
You know, it seems like operationally there's consensus that this needs to be resolved, but
right.
The things like information assurance and those types of things, the cyber threats and so forth, are the ultimately the roadblocks. But, you know, we kind of feel as an industry like we're beating our heads against the wall, yeah, trying to move this thing forward.
And I would challenge industry to, it's an education, because the cyber threat is so new and is so nebulous. You know, no one, you know, unless you're really in the cyber technology defense side, you're really, it's very scary. And when I think we can do a better job educating, you know, our congressional staffers, our policymakers, and then DOD. And we really do have the technology. I mean, it has made leaps and bounds within just the last 2 to 3 years on our ability to guard against these attacks. And I don't know if that word has gotten down to some of the lower-level staffers, both within DOD and state, on our ability to protect that. So, again, the immediate answer becomes no, because, you know, we didn't used to have an ability to protect, and now we do. So how do we get the word out? And it's forums like this where we could help educate people that we do have that ability and we can do this.
If I could, I just jump in just quickly.
Absolutely.
With one quick point? Because I think I'd be remiss not to add my understanding was also, I mean, we've been focusing on the Washington piece and the American piece, but part of it is just the political culture of our allies, mm-hmm, too. And they, until recently, have not played very well together. And we're seeing now, I think because of what's going on with the perceived heightened Iranian threat and their cooperation, the creation of the coalition to fight in Yemen, a degree of, we're seeing a transformation of their political culture, which might have potentially down the road some benefits here. But
in the past, my understanding is that there has been also significant obstacles to getting them to share information on their end, in addition to all the other policy obstacles on our side. So I think there's two sides of the piece,
That's a great point. Yeah.
Yes, Mike Elvin, the IISS. And I have just a follow-up with what Mike said. The GCC has been around since, 1981. It's not a military alliance. It's not like NATO. It's an economic, cultural, and political alliance. And to date, we have not seen a secretariat as a leadership group for security policy across the Gulf. How do we get, I guess, take advantage of the anxiety the Gulf governments are feeling, especially about Iran, but also the terror threat. How do we help, what policies do we implement to encourage greater cohesion within the GCC itself so that they can share? And right now, the only true military cooperation that occurs across the GCC is the International Coalition on Maritime Security. Where we operate. That has not been repeated in the air forces, the armies, or anywhere else.
I'll take that one. So I respectfully disagree. I think if you, on two different caveats. One, the GCC does have a standing entity for military cooperation under their peace shield. Right, wrong, or indifferent as you smile, operations in Bahrain were conducted. There's coalition operations going on right now in Yemen with a GCC, Qatar, UAE, Saudi, and others that are engaged in that. Is it the extent to what we see in NATO currently? No. Is it similar to, as I alluded to, what NATO looked like in the early 50s as we were standing up? I would argue yes. And I believe the Sea and Gulf Cooperation Council is, over the last 12 to 24 months, increasing at a expansive rate. And quite frankly, I think they're more out in front of us and the U.S.'s abilities to help integrate that and shape that. Because I think we tend to have that belief that there isn't cooperation in the Gulf Cooperation Council.
Well, let me ask a follow-up.
Sure.
Is there a GCC policy in place that defines the strategic vision for air and missile defense across the Gulf?
So there's a GCC Missile Defense Committee that is working on integrating policy. They just met. It was in an article in the paper in Dubai several weeks ago as they're trying to integrate this ballistic early warning system. I've seen various policy statements on that and part of that vision, and I know the agency was working with them to try to provide some ways to integrate those sensors, as we talked about. So I think that's part of this opportunity that we're talking about. If we have stronger advocacy and vision on part of our policymakers, we can help, you know, bring that together and form that.
Tom Carrico, CSIS. So, General Fedorov, you said something similar to kind of balance that I think a lot of folks talk about, especially right now, the emphasis on direct energy, real guns. It seems like a bright, shiny object gets a lot of attention. And yet you made the one comment that hit to kill will be here for a long time. That, I think, might need a little elaboration. Why is that? Why is it that we expect hit to kill is still going to be here, even though we hear good things about directed energy, et cetera? Because these other things, directed energy, railguns, cyber left launch, are getting, I think, so much attention.
Yeah, Tom, it's a good, very good question. I guess it sort of depends on your time horizon, and I suppose there's a scenario that says we get so good at all the other shiny object stuff in the future that you know, we've got the Death Star out there or something, and we can zap these guys before they leave the rail. But I believe, Ken's belief, that hit the kill will always be a part of the equation. Again, I look at this from a where you stand is what you sit. So where you stand is where you sit. So an operational perspective, as a warfighter, there's no sort of one good solution that is going to be one, you know, be all end all catch all. I've never seen one in my 30-year military career. There's always, you know, always having a backup plan is a good idea. So maybe it's that hit to kill will always be part of the equation, but it'll become lessingly so, or you know, diminished or reliance on hit to kill as the other stuff gets good. I also think that the shiny objects aren't going to be here tomorrow. And so there's a lot of folks out there that will say, well, we've got left to launch coming, so we can just, you know, ignore or start to defund or start to reduce our RDT&E effort on the work that we're doing to make hit the kill better. I think that's a mistake. And so I suppose there could be a day out there, probably not in my lifetime, frankly, and I'm 52, just so you know, do the actuary tables. I don't think in the next 30 years that hit to kill will be out of the equation, because Ken's view, the other stuff's coming, and it'll be a very viable part of the toolkit, but it'll never be, it's about defense in depth, and we've invested in hit to kill, and we've demonstrated that it works, and we're very effective with it, why would we do away with it as long as it's going to be a plausible, going back to the toolkit analogy, it's a plausible tool that works. Let's keep it as part of the equation, defense and depth. Thanks. I think their needs are the same as ours. We've gotten better at the integration piece, and there's some of you in the audience that are working pretty hard on it, things like IBCS for the Army, and the Navy's got their solution. I don't think that we've done a good enough job of coming to a common solution, and there's still varied interest out there amongst our own stakeholders domestically or within the United States. I think similar challenges for the GCC nations. And it's hard for me to quantify the actual gaps and seams. Mike might be better to do that, given his expertise in the region real time. But I think you're right. It's the integration is easily talked about and easily sort of wished away, but the proof is in the pudding, and the ones and zeros are hard to do. You want to add on to that?
So, if you look at the building a layered golf shield, and really we do have what I would say a good lower tier capability with numerous countries with Patriot and Patriot-like systems, and as we look at effectors, we're enhancing that. We've gotten into the realm of an upper tier capability in UAE, and as you alluded to, Qatar and Saudi are looking at that and the ability to provide that upper tier coverage. I would then argue there are holes as we look at the integrated air missile defense, as we look at an outer tier and an inner tier against cruise missiles in particular, but with the threat that Uzi alluded to, the rocket threat is alive and well. Depending on where you are geographically in the Gulf, a Zelzel or another unguided rocket is just as deadly as a tactical ballistic missile. So the need for what I would call an inter-tier counter-rocket artillery and mortar capability would be the next piece in that layer. And then you just need to go across the region, and depending on the threat, and you know, and there's various threats. You know, we've talked today about an Iranian threat, but obviously we're seeing missiles flying in Yemen. You know, there's a threat in Syria, and that capability and where you are geographically affects what your requirements are. So I wouldn't say it's a one-stop shopping for all, but if we look at that methodology of upper, lower, outer, inner tier, and then look at that threat, that would be the way forward. Is what I'd recommend.
So is that what you're looking at there? Something sort of like the Israeli Aero system?
A shorter range against rockets. That would be one that would be in the piece. And then, you know, as we alluded, the Holy Grail is, you know, directed energy and some other systems. Just because as you get into unguided rockets, there's so many of them. You know, how do you go one for one as you go forward? So, you know, that's really the next emphasis on the technology and where we need to go. And you made a great comment. You know, it's one thing to get those systems or pieces, but it's knitting them together is the crucial piece.
And either of you want to give an estimate for how much it would cost?
Not me.
Sorry.
Any other questions?
Yes, Joel Bernard, the Netherlands Liaison Officer for the US Navy. I have a question for Mr. Rubin. You talked about the Iranian missiles coming up to the medium range. Can you also a little bit elaborate about their possibilities to go for long range missiles?
ICBMs, maybe? ICBMs, would you be?
Well, not directly ICBMs, but the missiles are to 5,000.
The Iranians are keeping all the options open for all ranges. They're working on everything from unguided rockets to guided rockets to ballistic missiles, short range, long range. And in fact, they have a statement saying that we can make a missile to any range that we want. And I believe it. They have solid record. It's not a bragging. What you saw, what I showed, was solid engineering work. They have the capability. They have the human resources. They are investing in technical engineering. They have 10 technical universities now, creating about 250,000 graduates per year with an excellence program that takes the top 200 or 600 and give them jobs in the defense industry. And those are brilliant guys. So they have the capability. And I didn't want to talk about the deal, but let me say just one aspect of the deal. The deal is ostensibly not about missiles, just about nuclear.
Yeah.
But it is about missiles. First, because it leaves them out. And second, because it mentioned missiles. It takes the sanctions off what's called missile designed to be nuclear capable, which is gobbledygook. In engineering, it doesn't mean anything. It's either designed for or capable of. All their big missiles are capable of carrying nuclear missiles. And also, it's dealing with non-nuclear missiles and a certain procedure. But the main thing is this, not this. The main thing is the indirect impact. The Iranians have managed to build all the impressive capability on either Chinese, Russian, or whatever you want, technologies, with a mixture of smuggled technologies from the West. There are records of hundreds of attempts of them that were frustrated of buying Western technology to build those missiles, but we know about the cases that were frustrated. You can, it's like a drug trafficking. For each case that was frustrated, you can think about 10 cases that were successful. So to get the technology from the West, they had to smuggle. With the deal now in, and with the floodgates of commerce between the West and Iran now being opened up, you can count on it now that whatever they needed to buy surreptitiously and to smuggle, they'll be sold on the open under this or that pretext. In other words, from this point of view, what the deal I think is going to do is to accelerate the build-up of the Iranian missile threat, not just quantitatively but mainly qualitatively.
Thank you.
including the capability from beyond the Middle East, large capability to Europe and the United States.